Happy 2020. Happy New Year to all the folks I haven't seen yet. Carlos Mariotti, a state rep chair of the House Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Committee. I'm joined by my colleague, Chair Representative Jack Considine, who chairs the Corrections Subcommittee of our House Committee. And we're together going to call this this meeting to order. And welcome back to all these friendly faces, both sides of the aisle, and, from all over Minnesota. You know, it's really fun to watch people just sort of genuinely going up to each other, regardless of, you know, our community saying hello to one another. And hopefully that's a good spirit about how we're going to be engaged with in the coming weeks. I don't know about you all, but, you know, I could certainly wait another month or two for session. But it'll be on us very, very shortly. Today, we're going to have a hearing on issues related to the funding and cost issues related to our state facilities, correctional facilities, our prisons, as well as a conversation about our probation systems. One of the good things about having a hearing before our session begins is there's no bills before us. And so to some degree, we can just kind of let our hair hang down a bit, you know, and not get into those respective corners that we're really good at being in, and just kind of enter into a space where we can listen carefully to what's being laid before us, without the, the need to act and move on a piece of legislation at the same time. Let me just do a very couple of very, very quick things, and then I'm going to ask Chair Considine to say a few words as well. So this is really mundane, practical stuff. In your folders, you'll find members. You'll find a couple of subfolders. Please make sure to keep the red, if you have a red folder in there, to keep that, because that inside that folder, because that'll be, those are the contents for the subsequent meeting that we're having on race and law later on today. The other thing very quickly is, I'm going to try, and Chair Considine will as well, to keep us moving pretty effectively today. Precisely because we have another hearing an hour or two after this hearing. So with that, I'll come back and do a couple of very other quick introductory comments, but Chair Considine.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. And I get to do the housekeeping. Members, please take out and fill the blue slips for per diem and reimbursement before you leave the hearing room. Leave them in your folders. This is an informal hearing, so we won't be taking any legislative action. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, we'll not be taking public testimony. However, if there's any member of the public that would like to provide input, you're welcome to contact us directly and send any correspondence of interest on the matter of the to the committee administrator. Raise your hand, committee administrator. That's him. So. All right, now I'll turn it back over to Chair Mariani.
Thank you, Chair Considine. And members, Chair Considine will be taking over, will be chairing and have the gavel with the second half of this committee hearing's presentation. There are two parts to how we structured this hearing today. The first one is to have a presentation from the Department of Corrections on prison and probation population and cost issues. The second part will be a presentation by the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties and the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers on probation population and cost issues. The purpose of the hearing is to discuss issues related to state funding of our prisons and probation systems. Our hope is to provide information to legislators within the context of the public and the trajectory of prison and probation populations and the trajectory of their respective costs, and perhaps also a conversation about to what degree do our state criminal justice policies create either funding incentives or disincentives that contribute to those trends. And I'm really hoping that this information will provide us with strong information as we enter into the legislative session and continue to make the important decisions that we make in investing in our criminal justice system. So with that, I'm going to begin we're going to begin by hearing from our Commissioner, Department of Corrections, Commissioner Schnell. And the intent here, or the goal here, is to basically do 30 minutes of presentation, or up to 30 minutes of presentation, then followed by questions from members in the 15 to 20 minute range. And so please hold your questions. Certainly signal me, and we'll keep track of questions so that we can immediately move to those once the commissioner and his staff are have concluded their sharing with us today. So with that, welcome to the committee, Commissioner Schnell.
Good afternoon, chairs and members of the committee. It's a pleasure to see you all again. While I'm no longer the new guy, for purposes of the record, my name is Paul Schnell, and I have the honor of serving as the state's Commissioner of Corrections. Before I talk about costs to carry out the mission of our department, I want to let you know that over the last year, we've been working on the development of a new strategic plan for the agency. The plan was developed with the voices of many people, including more than 500 DOC staff members, system partners, and system-involved people. As we finalize the goals and objectives of the agency's new strategic direction, I'm honored today to share a few details with you. The DOC's new mission statement is to transform the lives for a safer Minnesota, transform lives for a safer Minnesota. Our vision is achieving justice through the promotion of racial equity, restoration from harm, and community connectedness. Our key priorities are improving safety, recruiting and retaining talented staff, the promotion of wellness, the practice of servant leadership, engagement of our employees and our community partners, and the modernization of agency operations and structure. In the coming weeks, we will finalize the strategic plan, including all of the corresponding goals and objectives for each of these key priority areas. When finalized, we'll be sure to distribute copies to all of you, and it will be available on our webpage. In addition to the goals and objectives, we've developed guidance, what we're calling I statements, for all the members of the agency to use in identifying and assessing what good looks like and how, as a member of our staff, we know we're doing it. In the last year, I have had the privilege of having hundreds, if not thousands, of conversations with staff, the people incarcerated in our prisons, those on supervision, their family members, community members, our professional partners, including community corrections, victim advocacy programs, treatment providers, social services, county probation staff, mental health advocates, and so many more. A product of the journey over the past year is a deeper sense of the awareness of the interconnectedness of all various aspects and components of the criminal justice system, and the system's role in carrying out the essential governmental function of ensuring public safety. The DOC's role is certainly at the back end of the criminal justice system is clear relative to our role in creating and transforming lives for a safer Minnesota, but transformation does not start nor end with corrections. Though important to our mission, we recognize that transformation requires more than safe and secure prisons and professionally delivered correctional supervision by supervision agents across our state. We recognize that public safety can only be achieved when the system, as a system, meets the needs of the people it serves where they are at. In order to transform lives for a safer Minnesota, we must have fair and reasonable policies that target and address the persistent disenfranchisement of people in our state because of their race, their ethnicity, their gender, their sexual orientation, their economic status, or their address. As it relates to this committee's jurisdiction, I realize that while I represent the Department of Corrections, I must also advocate for all other essential elements of the criminal justice system, including victim advocacy and safety services, a rigorous public defense system, a well-resourced judicial branch, problem-focused and community-oriented policing, the availability of specialized crime-solving services like our state's crime lab and computer forensics lab, and of course, prosecution services that achieve the state's objectives toward a more fair, proportionate, and balanced sentencing structure. Beyond this committee's jurisdiction, but most certainly within the interest of the people you all represent, is the requirement that we do as much upstream in our work as possible to invest in the education of our children, the strengthening of community connections, and creating meaningful opportunities so all people in our state have the ability to support themselves and their families. The governor and lieutenant governor have clearly laid the expectation that all state agencies go beyond the recognition of the intersectionality of our work and instead to work on mutually developing strategies that serve to meet the needs of the state of the people of our state. At present, the DOC has active interagency initiatives with the departments of Education, Public Safety, Human Services, Economic Development, and the Office of Higher Education and Housing. We look forward to the upcoming legislative session and the opportunity for us to discuss and debate policies to advance the mission of the Department of Corrections and to support a system-wide effectiveness in the creation of true public safety. With that, I would move into this, but I think it's been an incredible journey over the past year, and I'm grateful to all of you for the lessons I learned in my first year, and I think and many of the people who have helped guide me through this time, and it's my honor today to be able to talk a little bit about the funding and the structure of in our prisons and in probation.
Commissioner, thank you for providing that context. And I do look forward to seeing the plan and engaging in conversations around the mission statement. It struck me as you were sharing that one of the disadvantages of any new administration, regardless of political party, is that, the legislative session begins almost immediately after New Year's Day. Which means that any administration has at best 6 weeks after, maybe 8 weeks after the after they're assuming the grave responsibility for the executive branch to put together an agenda for the legislature to act on, which really means, I think, that it's very difficult to find time to do that deep, reflective, strategic thinking that is so necessary for all our government, state government to do. And so I'm glad to hear that it sounds like you and your staff wisely spent time doing that once we got past the incredible pace of the legislative session, and I do look forward to hearing more about you and your community's thoughts and direction coming forward. So all that by way of giving you a nice transition into your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So before we delve deeply into some of the data we want to share, I just want to provide again a quick overview of the department. The Department of Corrections is the third largest state agency. We employ just over 4,300 people across our state. We operate and maintain 11 facilities that house approximately 9,300 people. Of those 3,000 staff, they're made up of correctional officers, case managers, nurses, behavioral health staff, programming staff, probation officers, and many, many more. We also provide supervision and adult felony probation supervision and IS and supervised release supervision in 53 counties that are not part of the Community Corrections Act. In addition to felony services, the DOC is also responsible for providing juvenile and misdemeanor probation services in 29 counties. We are essentially broken into three broad divisions. That is the Facilities Division, and Operations Division, and the Community Services Division. The department's annual budget is just over $611 million, and 96% of our funds come from the state's general fund. The largest proportion of those dollars are spent in our facilities division. And you've heard us mention per diems quite a bit over the years. The daily cost of incarcerating an individual in Minnesota's prison in fiscal 19 was $104.98 per day. For those of you who sit on the Capital Investments Committee, you also know that the DOC has significant deferred maintenance issues, and today ultimately are looking at $600 million in deferred maintenance costs. As we discussed before in this committee, prison is the most expensive end of the criminal justice system spectrum, and a resource that we believe must be used efficiently and as effectively as possible. In addition, as you know, and as you're going to hear from today, our colleagues from MACAC and MACPO will be sharing with you perspective on what they do. The Department of Corrections does have responsibility for providing an oversight of the pass-through funds, which you all allocate. As you can see from the slide, approximately just shy of $65 million in fiscal 19 was the community corrections subsidy, and CPO subsidy was $6.4 million. In total, you can see just shy of $72 million in total pass-through money from the Department of Corrections to counties to provide services in their local jurisdiction. When we look at the historical context for where we are today and in terms of our correction system, we note that during the 2000s, our correction system, in particular our prisons, saw an incredible growth in prison population, 62% growth. We went in 2000 to 2009 from 5,700 people in our prisons to just over 9,000, roughly the number we are at today. When we look at this, we also think it's important to note that the DOC capacity has increased over the course of time with the addition of Rush City. We in the past had used and contracted for bed space at the correctional facility in Appleton, and there has been expansion, an addition of K buildings or housing buildings at Faribault. In 2010, since over the last decade, those capacity numbers have been largely static, and our prison population has been for the most part static. When we look at the question of who's in our prisons and what's projected and where what's actual, this gives you some sense. The actual numbers have been largely on target, although you can see that when we look at actual, we are just slightly above our projections at present, just slightly below our projections in terms of prison population today, by just a very small number. We have seen over the course of time, however, and I think this becomes really important. When we think about where we are at the peak, at a population of over 10,000, why has there been this more recent drop in our population? And when we look at that number, we can see that the place where reduction has happened is in the admissions of probation violators and supervised release violators. Part of this reduction is due to a policy change that was enacted in 2018 that prevented some from violating being revoked and requiring restructuring and alternative sanctions to return to prison. We'd also note that there are projects either in development or actually have been underway in a variety of counties that have been focusing specifically on this population. And we have seen in certain counties, there has been a marked and notable reduction in the number of violators that are coming into the system. There are really two main factors that that affect the size of our prison population, and that really is grounded in these admissions. When we look at admissions, new court admissions in fiscal 19 comprised roughly 43% of the total admissions for that year, and made up about 76% of the overall population as of January 1st of this year. The average length of stay for somebody being sent to our prison is roughly 32 months. But here's one of the places that we see some significant issues, and we'll talk about why in just a second. 23% of the admissions in fiscal 19 were made up of probation violators, which as of the January 1st reflected 13% of our population. These folks have an average length of stay of roughly 10 months, just slightly less than that. Supervised release violators, those folks that have been in and sent back to prison, oftentimes for a technical violation, sometimes for violations of more significant, made up 34% of our admissions in fiscal 19 and reflected 11% of the state's prison population on January 1st. And those people have an average length of stay of 4 months or less, slightly less than that. Now, what this ultimately does is it creates a tremendous amount of burden in terms of the churn of the people coming into prisons for very short periods of time. And ultimately, it results in what we would say is warehousing. When we focus on this, we can look at the fact that when 60% of our admissions are probation and supervised release violators, we have to pay attention to those numbers and then ask the question about the effectiveness of returning them or bringing them into prison. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we get into this further. Of the 7,857 releases in Minnesota prisons in 2018, 3,000 of those people had a length of stay of less than 6 months. Not surprisingly, two-thirds of those with less than 6 months were supervised release violators. So this population, it creates a lot of churn and puts a lot of demand on the prison system and the ability of the prison system to respond to and address the needs that these people have. And in fiscal year 2019, 28% were for 90 days or less. 1,400 of these people were admissions for supervised release violations, 370 for probation violations, and about 130 were new court violations. So again, these are people whose admissions are going to be they're going to come into prison with less than 30 days. And even if you look at that, 137 of those people are coming in directly sentenced. And in most cases, those folks have received may have had a year and a day sentence. And because they were in jail and they got credit for time served, they had less than 90 days remaining on that sentence. In fact, there have been times and occasions where people have been brought back, brought into prison on a Monday to be released the following day on their supervised release date. And these things come at tremendous cost to the system, to the churn that happens. Why is churn an issue? We think that ultimately it is a profound waste of resources, of taxpayer money, because what ends up happening is these people are brought back, oftentimes plucked out of the community, where admittedly they are struggling. And that could be in 60% of the cases, roughly, these people are struggling with a relapse, for instance, 30 UAs. It could be housing in some cases. It could be noncompliance with the directions of their agent or failure to maintain contact with their agent. It could be a variety of things. It could, in some cases, be the result of an accusation or being criminally charged with a new offense in a small percentage of those cases. Churn also chokes the system and affects the people that are there, our ability to program, the stability of what happens in our housing unit, the milieu inside of the environment within inside of our facility, correctional facilities, is challenged. And when we look at Stillwater as a for instance, we see a high number of people, release violators coming in there, again, short periods of time, are brought into that facility, and it has profound impact on the stability of that population. When they're brought in, these people are oftentimes unable to access programming. So we may not be able to get them into treatment programming. If we establish a treatment directive, they will stay in some cases, waiting for that treatment directive to be completed. And that's further complicated by the fact that today, hiring licensed alcohol and drug counselors is really challenging, as much as the challenge we're having around hiring and maintaining and retaining mental health therapists in the prison system. And these challenges create massive concerns. And one of the things, as we begin to think about how do we address this and how do we meaningfully meet the needs of these people, is really something that we believe has to get addressed, that we have to get our hands around this. And we've had great conversations with our partners with the Community Corrections Act counties in talking about the fact that there are ways, we believe, to not address all of these cases. There's no way that that's going to happen. Nowhere, are we going to reduce 1,100? All these people are going to be able to be released. But we do believe that with adequate resources, that there is meaningful solutions to address these issues and maintain public safety at the same time. I just want to give you one example. In fiscal year 2017, 293 women came in, on these were new commits, came into Shakopee less than 30 days on their commit, less than 30 days. Now, a cost of an intake, when we take all the costs to process somebody in the prison, all the intakes, the work that gets done, all the assessments that happen, comes at a cost of about $1,300 per inmate coming into the prison. So in Shakopee alone, those women that came in with to serve the remainder of their sentence, less than 30 days, came at a cost in that year of just shy of $400,000. And when we think about what happens, it has a great impact, as we said, on program eligibility. It can, we believe, increase and contribute to issues around homelessness. We also know that in some instances, we've seen where people who are in community may have failed, may have had problems with maintaining their sobriety, as a for instance, had quote-unquote dirty UAs or tested positive for the use of a controlled substance, which is clearly a violation in these cases. But they've been maintaining their employment, their housing is stable, and in some cases they are supporting a chunk of their family. And we think that when we think about the totality of these people, we have to begin to look at that. And I think there is interest by us and our partners in doing that. I mentioned earlier that what we're doing essentially is warehousing people. And we believe that is fundamentally dehumanizing. It crowds out effectiveness of our ability to intervene and certainly affects the safety and the morale of our staff, as well as the people who are incarcerated. We also know that warehousing is itself a criminogenic factor, that when we bring people in, we actually, through this intervention, have the create worse outcomes. We make them worse. We create situations where they are more likely to reoffend. And then when we consider that given the warehousing issues, and looking at the we know that these are the people that have the worst misconduct, both within the facility as well as in supervision. They have the poorest employment and recidivism outcomes. And I think as the quote states, warehousing is simply highly costly and an ineffective practice, and something that we believe as we have to be responsible about acknowledging and recognizing, and we have to do something to apply the current and best practices, evidence-based practices, to achieve better outcomes for the sake of these folks, their families, and ultimately for public safety. Our ultimate goal, as we look at this, is that we want to maximize community safety and prosperity by delivering the best transformative correctional services in the least restrictive environment, and doing that in the most cost-effective manner possible. And we do believe that we can really be smart in terms of our policies, and effectively intervene, make good investments in people's long-term well-being, and ultimately make them active and fully participating members of the social fabric of Minnesota. We also believe that by doing this, we can build more capacity to deliver really exceptional services for those people that are in our prisons on a longer-term basis. We believe that we are at a critical decision-making point with our system. As we think about this, and certainly all of the data is pointing to the fact that as we think about corrections and its costs, both economic and social, it becomes important that we really give high emphasis to evidence-based treatment and programming that we know works. But because of warehousing and churn, it makes it very difficult for us to do that. I point out that while this may seem a bit grim, I will tell you that we are far better off than some places. You may have read or seen lately that in Mississippi, 12 people who are incarcerated in Mississippi's Department of Corrections have been killed since December. What's happening in prisons across our nation is that the ability to staff them, the ability to meaningfully intervene, becomes more challenging, and oftentimes the policies that we create in terms of in our desire to what we believe make more safe communities, in fact, is creating an entirely different problem in another area. And as I said in my opening comments, we believe that this is we have an opportunity today to think about the totality of our criminal justice system and delivering meaningful services both to the victims, to the people who are involved in these offenses, to make sure that people are adequately and fully represented. We believe that these are not competing objectives. We believe that this is about creating a responsible and responsive criminal justice system. And we look forward to being a part of working with you to achieve that end. And with that, Chairs, I would stand for any questions that you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm sorry, thank you, Commissioner. You probably heard the gasp from some members about the information you shared relative to Mississippi. You know, tragically and unfortunately in our own state, you know, we had one death within the last 14 months or so, and in one of our facilities, and it had been quite a while prior to that. But I have to say, one death was enough to shake the conscience and the soul of the people of Minnesota. So I just can't imagine 12 deaths in such a short period of time. So it sounds to me, just to sum up, that you know, that there are a couple of drivers, if you will, relative to our state facilities. One is that there's an overall, this is my language, less newer admissions through the traditional, you know, adjudicated and sent forward to a facility happening. Simultaneously, there's, to use your phrase, a churning dynamic that's happening with those who are on either supervised release or in a probation category that itself is then posing some challenges. I could tell you when I was in Stillwater last year that a couple of guards shared with me the incredible, well, and actually some of the residents, the incredible challenges that change in the population, you know, poses for managing a prison, both in terms of managing it safely, but also in terms of residents accessing the kind of skill building opportunities that many of them badly want so that they can move on with their lives. So there's a couple of issues that are there, but overall it sounds to me like we're at a critical juncture. And this is, you know, one that we'll be wrestling with, right, colleagues? A critical juncture about what do we put into motion? What do we contribute in terms of any motion relative to the investment in our correction system? And I know I'm oversimplifying it, but, you know, roughly, you know, the question becomes, do we invest in our mainstream traditional approaches and the use of our facilities to do that, or do we invest in alternatives to that? It seems to me that that's a critical question. I'm trying to be really careful with my language here because there are constituencies connected to both of those, but I think, you know, as I hear your presentation, I think it's one of the big things that, you know, or is like the big thing that's being laid out for us. And so just, you know, quickly just looking for affirmation and clarification about that. And then simultaneously, it seems to me, I'm going to pull out from your presentation that that there is opportunities, putting it optimistically, there are opportunities for investing in some new things and perhaps even investing in some new things that we've piloted and have attempted to do in the form of alternatives, primarily in our probation system. So anyway, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, I think you're absolutely right. I think when we look at this juncture question, I think if we go back to that proposition that we just talked about a second earlier, looking at this notion of least restrictive environment, it's how do we achieve community safety, ensure compliance, address people's needs and the risk associated with them in a responsive manner, and do that again as far upstream as the back end of the system can do, and that may mean that it's best to do that, we believe, when they're in the community. But in order for that to happen, there has to be resources. As we think about the future of corrections, and in talking to people who are in the role that I have the honor of serving in across the country, on both sides of the aisle, there is an increasing level of attention given to this for a variety of reasons. One of them is simply the sustainability question. Two is the fact that we can look at the simple workforce needs of our state and states all around the country, and we have to look at the fact that our viability may depend on trying to engage the folks that are today in our correction system, whether that's in prison or maybe under employed and on supervision in the community. this is a critical need for Minnesota and really states around our country. So whatever brings people to that, to these questions about how do we do this in the most effective way possible, recognizing that public safety is paramount. And then thinking about this from the standpoint of, again, we cannot just do great correctional service without thinking about the needs of victims or having rigorous law enforcement and strong public defense. We have to think about system, and we internally are talking about the ways in which we do this better, that are there strong and handoffs between when people are leaving our prisons, between the case management and inside the facilities and the agents who are going to be providing that supervision and support as they leave. So the more we believe that we can do to keep people in the community and ultimately even look to invest and develop resources that meet not simply the needs of our correctional population, but if we can improve and provide resources that meet the broader needs of whatever county in the metro or greater Minnesota, we think that ultimately that is in the best interest of Minnesota as well as the people that are in our system. So certainly as much focus as possible on trying to address need and risk in the community is the investment that we believe is smart.
Well, Commissioner, I look forward to the department's proposals in the coming days. We have several members. I'll try to keep us moving quickly. Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I really just have a clarification that I probably should ask in the middle of the commissioner's presentation, which is just if you can define what you mean by warehousing. I feel like I have a guess as to what you mean by that, and probably, but just not being a corrections professional, I feel like there's maybe an angle on that and what the opposite is of that would be really helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. I think it's a good question, and I should have provided that. When we think about warehousing, we're really thinking about the fact that we are bringing them back without engaging them, that essentially they're going to come back in for that, in this case, a supervised release is going to be somewhere in that 4 month or less range. They are going to sit oftentimes without access to any type of meaningful employment in some cases, whether that's in our industry programs. They are not going to get into treatment programming because our treatment program beds are full of the people who are going to be closer to release from their primary sentence, so we don't have the capacity. So oftentimes, when we talk about warehousing, it is they are there for the sole purpose of being there, and we do nothing to improve their stead, and we bring them right back in most cases and pluck them right back into the very community that we pull them out of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And if I could just comment, as somebody who doesn't have the chance to serve on Chair 9's committee, this feels like a really important point to me, that I feel like we have a sense just in the public of, you know, somebody commits a crime for which they deserve to be incarcerated, let's say, and then the idea is they get put someplace and then they come back. We're just not thinking much about it. I really appreciate what you're talking about, that in fact that aspect of corrections, that is what is happening when they are out of the community and then that environment, is just so critical. I really want to make sure that we are continually having that in mind, because I think that we generally don't when we think about prisons, and we really should. That's so important. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Miller.
thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner, thank you for that presentation. I guess in my notes I started with, I hear you. And you and I have had one-on-one conversations on this. And I get it about the warehousing and the churn that you're talking about. And you described it extremely well. I think you painted a good picture of that. The challenge that I have is not in that being a truth, but it's the what we do next. So what I kind of heard, and I know you're going to be coming forward with some alternative options in the future, but most of them, I believe, that are probably going to be an emphasis on the probation system or a supervised release or something along those lines. So my concern with that is, and I also see, by the way, with policy in the state of Minnesota moving towards, when people are convicted, to try and put them in a probation system instead of incarceration. I think that's one of the reasons why our incarceration rates are down. There's a couple problems I see with that that I either I need you to address now briefly, or at least as you present the alternatives, is as I see our probation, when I've talked to some of the probation officers and other people, is that that system is really overburdened right now and lacking in its capability of doing its mission. And so if we're putting more downward pressure on that, you know, just last year, I know that MACAC, which we have to come up with a better acronym than that, but MACAC once again came forward with some funding, and then it got, you know, cut on the editing floor in the end, which is what tend to be what happened. Well, okay, that happens with budgets, but they're still being expected to do some of this stuff. My other concern that I would also throw just briefly, it's not really the thrust of what you're talking about, but when we put this pressure on the probation from maybe the conviction side, which I want to hear about this in the future as well, is I've seen justice not being served in my community directly on cases to where someone went into a probationary sentence, if that's how the way properly way that you say it, that the victims feel that justice was not served, okay? And so those are the two challenges that I see. I hear what you're saying, especially with the warehousing. That second part is for maybe another time. With the warehousing, I get it, but when you come forward, I mean, maybe you could give us a little insight right now as to some examples of how you see we can be a positive, have a positive effect in the probationary system when it comes to people rather than warehousing, which I agree with you with. But how are we really, because I have probation officers that talk about like drive-by probation and terms like that, and I don't like hearing stuff like that. I want to make sure that if one of these people that tripped up, they're getting the services they need, but for the sake of public safety, that the public's being taken care of as well. So if you could just briefly address that, that would be great. Thank you.
And Commissioner, we will circle back to this in the next part of this, but and so I don't want to hold you up. Well, please, yeah, if you can provide us just a quick...
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, and I'll let the MACAC folks can describe that, but certainly I will tell you that in the conversations we've had, we have to resource that. This, otherwise, it becomes an unfunded mandate. And that does not serve local communities well. It certainly doesn't serve these folks well. We have to find a way to fund addressing the needs of these people in the community. And I think we have some good examples. You know, Representative O'Neill brought forward a project that Anoka has been doing and has been achieving some nice outcomes. Similarly, in Dodge, Fillmore, Olmsted, there's a project that we've been doing as more of a demonstration. Ramsey is building one, and they're all learning from each other, and it's a great way, and we're seeing, we think, what will be a movement toward the ability to do good, sound correctional practice and public safety, provide public safety supervision in a meaningful way and not use warehousing as a means of how we respond.
Thank you.
Representative Miller, I look forward to us working on supporting and unearthing some of those in the coming weeks. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I have a clarification question, because I was running the numbers of your 2017 example at Shakopee. I remember correctly, the last time I was there, the population was about 640. Can you just tell us again how many women were there for less than 30 days and what the cost of intake was? And then I have a couple follow-up questions.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, it's the difference is it's around admissions. So, because we have far more admissions,
yep,
during the course of a year.
If I find that sheet here.
There's 384,000 was the total amount of money. That the annual cost of that, it was 293 women came in with stays of less than 30 days at a cost of $1,328 each.
Okay.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you explain to us the process where, I realize they've kind of come to the end of their 1 year in jail, although I used to be a jail volunteer and I know there are many people that stay there longer than 1 year for one reason or another. Is there something legislatively we could do to allow them to stay where they are and not burden the DOC?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, yes, there are some things. We've had some conversations about this. I think that there was some policy around some of this. We think there are things that we can do to address that in working with the sheriffs. And part of this is just some information sharing, but there are some opportunities, yes.
Commissioner Murillo.
Thank you. I want to talk just quickly about the Alternatives to Incarceration Program. And, you know, I worked on that piece of legislation collaboratively with Minnesota Adult and Teen Challenge, RS Eden, and several of the DOC folks that aren't with you anymore. So, but they work very hard and very diligently. And as you said, the first pilot project had a 62% reduction in recidivism, which is outstanding. My question is, we had tried to expand it across the state. The chair was very gracious in seeing the success and wanting to move it forward. Can you tell me just your thought process about maybe even allowing other nonprofits? Because obviously Minnesota Adult Teen Challenge has a very high success rate. They have about an 85% or so success with those that complete the program. RS Eden has a good success rate. Have you thought about taking that money and allowing it to be used in the nonprofit sector as well? And if not, are there some impediments there?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Neal, yes. We have been working to try and stretch dollars as best we can around trying to expand some of these projects, trying to find ways to test what we believe is the ability of the system to respond in meaningful ways. And one of the things that we're doing, as I said earlier, we're creating some of these partnerships with even other state agencies. So we're working with DHS, MARCH, which is all the treatment providers, the Association of Treatment Providers. We've been working with them very closely. Adult and Teen Challenge has been involved, and really treatment providers across our state. And we believe that there are some things that in partnership with both counties across our state, our agents across our state, and even law enforcement around our state, the ability to find direct access to treatment for those people that need it, which is in our state's best interest and economically in our best interest, there's some new vehicles for that to happen. And we are looking to launch that and work on that. The DOC has been actively involved with that and with them and with the Department of Human Services. And we think that that's going to provide some big opportunities for us to address the needs of people in a very efficient and quick manner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'm very excited to hear that because that was sort of the impetus of the whole thing and keeping people in community, as you had said, and all the it kind of hits all those factors and checks all the boxes. The last question I have is about Stillwater. And I was there for Officer Gom's memorial, very sobering day. And when I was at Rush City with you just last week, I happened to speak to one of the captains from Stillwater and asking him how's the morale and how are things there. And, you know, he expressed that it's still very challenging and it's really hard to hire people. So they're overworked, overburdened. And just wondering, what can we do here? Is there more that we can do here at the legislature to support the work that's happening in Stillwater? And really, I know it's across your system, but they've been hit particularly hard. Is there something that we can do to help?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm grateful that you asked. I think it's this has been probably one of the biggest challenges that we've faced. We know that coming from law enforcement where and being involved in a department where there was a death, I know that the impact of that on an environment has some lasting impact, it creates a variety of challenges. We're responding in ways to provide more meaningful support to staff there, but we are trying to be as creative as we possibly can, because we know that what's happening is we're forcing incredible numbers of our staff to work double shifts. We know that this certainly is contrary to the safety interests, even the ability just to having to come into work and just know that that today I'm probably going to get forced. This is not a periodic occurrence. This is every single day. And again, I would just say that I'm a listserv with commissioners from around the country. And departments of corrections around the country are struggling with the same thing. And you've seen in some states have done some pretty incredible moves of releasing high numbers of people. Some of that may be very positive, but some of that without the kind of appropriate safety net. that we think is essential. And so we are providing more support there. We have activated a new employee support and wellness response team. We're spending a lot of time at Stillwater trying to resource that as best we can. One of the biggest changes that we've just enacted that we think is critical is we have really focused to reduce population at Stillwater to single bunking. And I would just say that if there's a lesson that comes out of a lot of this, double bunking, while it's grounded in our we have statutory authority to do it, does not make our prison safer. And it's contrary, I believe, to the state's interest in the long haul. We're glad that we finally have that single bunked at Stillwater.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Senator. Thank you, Commissioner. I have to say, in all the years that I've been here for a lot of years, I can't think of a more painful period of time or instance or event than when you and I and Chair Considine, Representative Christensen, visited Stillwater, and what was originally, I think, supposed to be like a 3-hour engagement became a 6-hour plus engagement. And the most painful period of time was when we sat with our COs on the heels of the death of their colleague. And I have to say, quite honestly, even as we sat with the residents who expressed their sadness over what happened, and were real painful that the action of one person wound up reflecting horribly on them, but nonetheless pointed to some systemic challenges that perhaps contributed to that. So, a very painful period of very painful event. Thank you, Representative O'Neill, for raising that question. Members, we have two individuals left for questions. I'm sorry, Commissioner, I'm going to keep you here. But I'm going to ask you to be very brief and quick, because we do want to have the MACPRO and the CAC people have their time, good time with us. So we have Representative Johnson, and then we have Representative Bean. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Schnell, first of all, I'd like to thank Representative O'Neill for asking that question. It's
early in the season.
I'm really concerned about the safety of the staff. You talked about the unfortunate death of Officer Gom. For those of you who don't remember, a friend of mine 24 years ago this morning was killed in St. Joseph, Officer Brian Kleinfeld. Those names keep ringing, and I see them all the time. In fact, I've been to the law enforcement memorial in D.C., and I have the rubbing of his name. But it comes back again to some of the things. I have a couple questions and one clarification. You had mentioned in your slide that the capacity of our has been mostly static of our prison beds. But you mentioned that our prison population has been static as well. In the presentation, says it's not been static. So I'm wondering, what is it? Is it
Commissioner, quickly. Yeah, I noticed that verbiage as well. I was going to ask it at the time, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I think when we look at that, we go back into the 1990s and into 2000, we saw dramatic increases in our population, up over 10,000. Then over the course of time in the 2000s, there has been periodic upticks, but it has not been dramatic. It's been largely static. But some of the biggest challenges is that we are at capacity. And we've been largely, when we were at over 10,000, we had a high number of people housed in Hoff, upwards of 400 to 500 people a day were housed in jails around the state. So the demand on our system, we were over our capacity. So today, when we talk about our prison population, ultimately is our capacity, our ability to house people is static. We're full. Our population can move, but our capacity is static.
Professor Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Snell, you also mentioned the unfortunate 9 deaths in the prison in Mississippi. 12 deaths in Mississippi. I'm just wondering if you know any of the circumstances, whether it's due to gang activity, riots, or something else, or a combination of things.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there has been a variety of things. Mostly of that unrest has really come from, in part, idle, the high number of idle inmates. So people that are warehoused is one of the problems. The inability for recreation, inability to get showers, and ultimately these things have erupted into riots. Then add to that the complications of reduced staffing. Those have been the factors that have ultimately increased the levels of violence in Mississippi's prison system, along with certainly the influence of things that are happening in the community. Some gang violence in the community that certainly spills over into these facilities, but facilities that are well staffed, that have the ability to engage the population inside that facility. Ultimately, that's what will help aid and maintain safety in that environment.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner Snell, I guess I'm doing some just brief studying quickly on the situation that happened down there. The Clarion Ledger did an investigation into it, and they found out that gang rules in the prisons down there, despite a zero tolerance by the officials. Inmates describe how gang members stab people down and nothing happens to them. That's a concerning. And when I'm talking to prison guards and staff all across this state, I'm hearing the same thing from them. I'm concerned about staff safety. And when they tell me stories of where even the warden requests a certain level above what he's authorized to do for disciplinary actions, it's turned down by the deputy's commissioners. That when the prisoners hear that, they know they can get away with almost anything. That's something that needs to be looked into, and looked into right now. It should have been looked into already, because I'm just concerned about the staff safety. If the prisoners are running, if the inmates are running the asylum, we're in trouble.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I can assure you that We operate a system that does hold people to account, and I think we saw, in fact, a recent report that was published in the Star Tribune. It was turned over here around the use of restrictive housing as a disciplinary intervention. To say that we're not using these tools would be utterly and completely inaccurate. We do believe, however, that and all of the data points to this, that we have to be judicious in our use of these tools, because it's simply contrary to the safety of our facilities to overuse them. And to be frank, that research has been clear all around the country, to the point where in many states where they have enacted restrictive housing policies that are very limited, it's a very, very limited ability to be able to have people access them, there has not been an uptick in violence. I will also tell you that you know, we knock on wood, because I think we can't draw conclusions between one and another. There's not causation cannot be established between these things. But I will tell you that staff assaults are down. No assault of staff, no assault of anyone in our facility is acceptable. And I think that it has to be and should be our goal. At the same time, our history of using disciplinary segregation, restrictive housing, did not make our system safer. We have our own evidence of that. And so I think we have to be really smart about the policies that we enact.
Thank you, Commissioner. Members and Representative Dean, I want to apologize to you because we really do, we can come back to that. We'll come back to you, Representative Dean. I really want to get our testifiers in. We're still being here. We can don't believe the commissioner is going to go anywhere. And so we'll come back to your question. So with that, Chair Considine, I'm going to ask you to take the gavel and then direct us through the next portion of this hearing.
Could we have our testifiers come down to the table, please? Minnesota Association. While they're setting up, I'd just comment on Representative Miller's question. I think it is incumbent upon us to recognize the difference between public safety and violations that are technical in nature. And I think that's where we can kind of concentrate on the churn in the warehousing. Yes, if there's something that's a public safety risk, I don't think any of us are wanting to have that change. You guys ready?
Yes.
Please identify yourselves for the record, please.
Thank you, Chair Considine and Chair Mariani and members of this committee. My name is Travis Granzee. That's G-R-A-N-S-E-E. I am the Community Corrections Director in Dodge, Fillmore, and Olmsted County. And I'm here today, honored to be here today, representing MACAC, which is the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act Counties. An affiliate of AMC, and many of my colleagues are seated over here today to be here for this hearing. So,
good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Terry Fawcett, F-A-W-C-E-T-T. I'm the Director of Pine County Probation. I'm currently the President of the Minnesota Association of County Probation Officers and a previous President, 2011, of the Minnesota Corrections Association. Honored to be here amongst you today, a lot of my colleagues there as well. An honor to be sitting here with my counterpart from MACAC.
So as we begin this presentation and share information, I want to start by saying thank you for your interest in learning more about corrections. We appreciate these committees seeking to understand more to ensure that the investments made by the state are wise, protect public safety, reduce recidivism, and create the greatest return on our investment. So thank you for that. Today we plan to share just a brief overview of the delivery systems in Minnesota, talk a little bit about Community Supervision 101, transition to some information provided by the County Probation Office, and then transition back to myself where we'll talk about kind of the intersection between community supervision and the institutions that we just heard a lot about from Commissioner Schnell. So we'll try to move through this rather quickly to allow time for questions, but at the same time, spend enough time on this so that you have a good understanding. So thank you. Just a real quick overview of community supervision in Minnesota. The counties and the Department of Correction that are responsible for those folks that are in the community on supervision supervise about 112,000 people on any given day. So that's just kind of the volume and the numbers that we're talking about. There are three delivery systems for community supervision in the state of Minnesota, and that makes us pretty unique. Minnesota is unique in that regard. So I just want to share with you real quickly, and you'll see a map up on the screen that identifies which county belongs to which system, if you will. The Community Corrections Act county, they provide probation and supervised release supervision in 34 counties and supervise about 76,000 folks on any given day. Those are felonies, supervised release, misdemeanors, gross misdemeanors, and juveniles in those Community Corrections Act counties. So it's all of the above, if you will, in those counties. In the Department of Corrections counties, they provide felony and supervised release supervision, and that occurs in the CPO counties and then just in the rest of the counties that also the Department of Corrections supervises. So there's this there's a blend here. We've got community corrections does it all in some places. The Department of Corrections does it all, where they supervise all of those same offense types. And then in the middle is the hybrid, which is the CPO counties that Mr. Fawcett will talk a lot more about. But in those cases, they supervise pretrial and juvenile and misdemeanors and gross misdemeanors. And the Department of Corrections provides the felony level supervision in those counties. So the state of Minnesota has these three different options that really allows for local choice. There's a lot in common across those three delivery systems. We all approach client supervision based on the evidence, and we're all really working towards making sure that the interventions that we apply to the clients that we serve are really evidence-based. We all do a lot of great training for our staff. Our staff are highly trained, highly competent. We've, I think collectively would say, we've got awesome people doing this work on the front lines every day. And we complete a lot of similar tasks. I mean, the tasks that get done by our offices look very similar. And the three of us work pretty well together when it comes to policy changes. So we're here today sharing information with you. The Department of Corrections, Community Corrections, and the County Probation Offices are here today talking about some of these policy changes. There are some differences, though, with those systems. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, who makes decisions, who sets the vision, who determines the priorities. Is it the Department of Corrections? Is it the county? Is it the bench in partnership with the county? So you'll see some differences then in regards to how these services actually get applied and implemented in those communities. So we've already heard from the Department of Corrections, and pretty soon here I'll turn it over to Mr. Fawcett to talk a little bit more about the county probation offices. So I just want to take a moment to provide a little bit of the information in regards to the Community Corrections Act counties and how some of those decisions get made and what it is that we try to do. You know, the Community Corrections Act, you'll see here, was started in 1973. And the idea was, and these are some of the themes that you heard from Commissioner Schnell earlier, the idea was the communities are in the best position to actually provide the services that the clients need. So I like to look back at this document because I believe they had it all figured out in 1973. I really do. Somebody like this decided on this act, and it included language like, it makes little sense to banish the lawbreaker from the community, place him in a disorientating, artificial situation, and expect him to return home well-adjusted. The idea is, like, we're in the best position in the local communities to provide the type of interventions and services that the clients need in order to not return to the system and return to law-abiding behavior. And this just the plain fact that incarceration in remote institutions is more likely to have a detrimental than a beneficial effect. You heard Commissioner Schnell talk about that if we can't offer programming when they're in the institutions, it's really not doing anybody any good, and in fact, it increases their risk. So that's the whole premise behind the Community Corrections Act was we're in the best position at the local level to really provide the clients what they need. And if we can do so and still protect for public safety, we should. There's listed in this just some of the statutes that govern the Community Corrections Act and the County Probation Office, and just for reference for you if you wanted to do any additional research. So now for a minute, I just want to talk about community supervision and just a real basic overview, Community Supervision 101. And one thing that I think is really important to consider when we're talking about community supervision and we're talking about public safety, because I don't want you to hear anything today other than we all believe that protecting the public still remains a real significant priority for us. But I want to talk about public safety in a little bit different terms today in regards to short-term public safety and long-term public safety. We can protect short-term public safety by putting people in jail or putting people in prison. But we also know that almost everybody comes out, no matter which of those places they're going. And they will be back in our communities. So one of our primary responsibilities, we really believe, is not only to tend to the short-term public safety, but really to create plans for the clients that we serve that create long-term public safety. And that means addressing what it is, what their needs are, and their drivers to their criminal involvement. So the idea that we can incarcerate ourselves out of the problems that we're faced with the clients that we serve is an idea that just doesn't work. We have to work towards the long-term public safety. The other idea to consider is we would really like to keep the institutions for people that we're scared of, not people that we're mad at. Sometimes the system is set up in such a way, and the commissioner spoke to this a little bit, that folks in regards to probation violations or the release violators that get returned to institutions, some of the churn there that the commissioner speaks to is in regards to maybe, and there's a question mark, there may be people that we're mad at. The judge has told you to do something, the commissioner has told you to do something in your release conditions, and you don't do it, and therefore you've broke the rule, and we're mad at you for doing that, right? But are those people that we're scared of? And I think that's, as the commissioner talks of some of the goals of the Department of Corrections, I think it's making sure that we're finding that line of incarcerating those folks that we're scared of and not the folks that we're mad at. Our whole work, and there's so much science behind our work, we're blessed right now to be in a position where we've got tons and tons of research about the corrections populations that we serve. So I want you to hear that what drives us and how we do our work, it's all based on science. And it really comes down to these three key principles: the risk principle, the need principle, and the responsivity principle. Risk is just making sure that we, all of us here, are putting our resources into those folks that are highest risk. We know that if we put resource into people that are low risk, we actually make them higher risk. So there's a science involved in doing risk assessments. And all of us here are committed to that science and making sure that we're doing risk assessments and serving the folks that we really need to serve. The need principle is really making sure that we target interventions based on the client that's in front of us, not based on the offense that brought them to us, but based on what they need in order to stay out of our system moving forward. And then the responsivity principle is really simple too. I mean, it's making sure that we're responsive to the need of that client and that we're using behavioral approaches. We've got so much science that tells us what works. Along with that, the shift that's happened over the course of the last few years is our staff, our probation officers that are meeting with these clients every single day, they're behavior changers. You know, this talks about behavioral approaches. They are behavior changers. So again, real quick on the risk principle, I mean, I've already talked about that some. I want you to see it visually. So here's a slide that just, without a risk assessment, you've just kind of got everybody in the pool, right? And then if we classify them by risk, we know who is at the greatest risk of reoffending. And then if we supervise based on that risk and make sure that we're providing the highest supervision and the programming for those that are high risk, that's where we really get the biggest bang for our buck, okay? And that's the science that we are now all using to make sure that we're making the best decisions possible with the people that we serve. The need principle, again, I've already talked about this a little bit, just intervene in the areas that we can change. And responsivity, you know, I think maybe in the old role for a probation officer was that probation officers were condition monitors. We've really shifted that. There's an expectation now that not only do they monitor those conditions that the court has ordered, but really their primary focus is on behavior change. And that behavior change, that work, takes more time. It takes a lot more time than it does to simply monitor conditions. So we'll get back to that in a minute. At this point, I'd like to hand it over to Mr. Fawcett, who's going to talk a little bit more about the CPO system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Granzi previously talked about what we do in the CPO delivery system. I think it's important to note that we supervise a lot of the rural parts of the state with populations under 30,000. So we'll get to that here in a little bit if you don't know more about that. We also used to work directly for the judges. New judicial policy came about in July. and now we've become county employees. Mostly a seamless transition, but it has been unique and a little bit different and somewhat challenging along the way as well. So I wanted to frame this today in kind of some real examples about, you know, a day in the life of a county probation officer. And so it's really timely today because we, in Pine County, we wanted a new position back in 2017, and we had to put a bunch of data together for that. And some of the things that I want to kind of just bring to everybody's attention today is some of those duties that county probation officers do. An analysis in 2017 to secure funding for an additional agent, it showed that 32.7% of an agent's time was spent doing a bail study, just sitting down in a jail, interviewing a client to see whether or not they should go out on pretrial. One-third of an agent's time. And then when they do a pre-sentence investigation, we found that it took an average of 5 to 6 hours to complete one of those. We do our own COG, cognitive skills programming in Pine County. In 2017, we did 303 contact hours from our probation officers in the evenings, once a week, with clients. There's been an exponential increase in the number of bail evaluations and supervision statewide. And the current reimbursement formula doesn't take into consideration supervision of the pretrial offenders or any of the juvenile work that is done. Pine County piloted dosage probation a few years ago. However, the highest risk offenders require 300 hours of intervention to decrease risk. And we just didn't have the resources in Pine County to accomplish dosage probation. Go ahead, Trav. Some of the other duties done by probation officers are listed anywhere from, you know, PSIs or PDIs, violation reports, domestic abuse assessments, fine determinations, gambling assessments, victim impact statements, restitution determinations, interstate compact investigations, certification investigations, and chemical health assessments. All those take a lot of time. Those are great examples of the challenges that a probation officer faces relative to their time. And as Mr. Granzi just pointed out, evidence-based practices, it's huge, and the commissioner mentioned it as well. It's important that we do that in the state. I want you to hear that first and foremost. But to do sound evidence-based work, it takes time, and it takes resources, and it challenges probation officers and sometimes challenges their safety. And we'll touch on that in a minute. Bail study reimbursement statute 629.74 says local corrections agencies should get reimbursed $25 per bail study. It's never happened. For Little Pine County, who did 453 back in 2017 on only the statutory mandated bail assessments, that would have been over $11,000. $11,000 maybe to a bigger agency is not a big deal, but to Pine County that adds up. Trends, you know, the governor's talked about publicly expressing his goal of giving increased focus to the criminal justice system and reform, as has the commissioner, and we agree. We believe there should be good probation reform. But as I've heard some members say today, good probation reform can also mean more stresses on probation systems when more people are in our communities. One thing that I want to stress again, I heard this earlier from one of the representatives about the dangerousness of our jobs. Our jobs are dangerous. I sit on a committee. A joint committee with the three delivery systems that talks about safety data with agents in the field. It's been a long time coming to gather that information to see how dangerous our jobs for probation officers out there, and we're almost to the point of rolling that out. But I can tell you a young female agent in Wright County had a gun pulled on her this year, and probably not too many people know about that, and has been battling since that time. Restorative justice, we talk about how important restorative justice is. If you do any correctional research, it'll tell you restorative justice, what is it? You know, giving victims an opportunity to be at the table. Yet almost no agencies do it. Why? Because it's labor intensive. It takes time. So just some other things about the local control and county probation system. Again, we work for the counties now. The one thing that's important to talk about here, though, before I conclude, is the statute 24419 about reimbursement of counties. The CPO system has not been funded at the 50% per the statute since 1996. So in Pine County, that comes out to almost $200,000 that falls on the back of a small county like Pine to come up with. And so that's been the biggest issue with the CPO world, is trying to fund us at that 50% so we can adequately staff our departments to do the job in the community. As less people are staying in prison, more are going out in the communities, we have to have the resources to be able to supervise them. Thank you.
All right, so we're going to now move in, and I understand we're going to be moving to questions here shortly, but I just want to, at the end here, really just talk about that intersect between community supervision and the institutions. Commissioner Schnell laid out a lot of information earlier in regards to the emphasis and the focus on trying to reduce the churn and to make sure that the folks that we're collectively serving are actually receiving services that are going to reduce their risk. So I want to talk a little bit about that. And just to start, I mean, and as a reminder, I mean, we've got the fifth lowest incarceration rate in the nation. So we start from, in my opinion, a pretty good spot in regards to how we're working with the clients. At the same time, we've also got the fifth highest rate of community supervision in the nation. So as the commissioner talks to the fact, and some of the representatives on this committee have raised questions about that, that is creating quite a burden on the local folks who are actually providing that community supervision. What we've also seen is this trend over time in regards to felonies. If you'll see there, back in 1996, there were about 27,000 folks on felony supervision. And what we see then as it moves towards 2018 is that number is now 46,000. That's a substantial increase of folks that have been charged with a felony offense. And when the commissioner talks about really our prison population staying fairly static, at least the last few years, you know, that those folks then that you see here, that increase to those felons who wouldn't otherwise be eligible to go to prison, that now lands on the folks' shoulders that are in this room from a community supervision perspective. So as the commissioner talks about us finding some really innovative ways to continue to deal with the pressure here, a lot of that is really going to fall back on those folks that are supervising in the community. We're all for it. We're all for some of this, the innovation that's being discussed. But we also then have to recognize where we're pushing that bubble, because that bubble will get pushed somewhere. Again, just another slide to demonstrate the felony convictions and the fact that they've increased substantially over the last several years. I think if this committee is really focused on that intersect between felonies in the community and those in the institutions, that community supervision explains why we've been able to keep the prison population in check. There have been some adaptations that have occurred already. There are more that need to occur, and community supervision has done that. As you look at this slide here, I'm going to just talk for a minute about the change in roles of corrections officers and probation officers in the community. We've really made a shift from referee to coach, and I kind of talked a little bit about this before, but to share a little bit more in that analogy, I mean, the referee's job is to blow the whistle, and when you break the rule, we blow the whistle, and we then issue a consequence for your breaking that rule, right? Now we've moved to this coach mentality where our probation officer's job is to help you change your behavior. That's my job, is to get you better and to help you change. So this change, this shift, it really comes back to the fact that being a coach takes a lot more time than being a referee. And our agents are feeling that. Again, the aim of corrections is public safety and through reduced recidivism, and it can't be achieved through just criminal sanctions. It just simply doesn't work. There's no research that would suggest to any of us that the punishment alone is going to change behavior. It's about the interventions. We will all maintain that those folks that are most dangerous to our communities need to be incarcerated, but probation is both economically and socially the best way to serve the folks that we're working with. So that gets us to the change, you know, and some of the questions that were posed earlier, some of the comments that Commissioner Schnell made, there needs to be some change. But keep in mind that supervision alone doesn't reduce recidivism. That as we ask our agents to do more, to try to change behaviors, which is ultimately what we're all focused on. We want to change behavior, right? We don't want these folks staying in our system, and especially our most expensive system. And as the commissioner described, $105 a day per diem, it doesn't cost us that much to do it in the community, right? We've got to change the way we fund the system as well. Supervision alone doesn't reduce recidivism. Changing behavior does. And that's what we're asking agents to do. It just takes a lot more time. The interventions matter, right? And those interventions, the best interventions that we have are all of the awesome staff we got back in our offices doing the work with our clients. That's our best intervention. And that's where we need to put our resource. The practice has changed. We've got the science that tells us the stuff we're doing now works. We believe in the stuff that we're doing now. It does work. The funding's got to follow. The research tells us what works. The funding's got to follow that. So with that, I'll stand for questions. Thank you for your time. We really appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you both. And I am struck by your last observation. It always seems to me that no matter what sector you're in, investing in your people is the best thing you can do and the best return that you can get, especially in this sector. With that, we do have a couple of questions right now. Representative Poston, and then followed by Representative Mulver.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is for you, sir, or the commissioner. You talked a little bit, the commissioner talked about warehousing, which is awful. Talked about the lack of programming for people that go into warehousing. And you talked a lot about the cost of churn. And I get all that, and that we would do a better job doing it locally. I hope you're working with Minnesota counties to understand that the additional burden that this can put on counties, and are counties prepared to take on this additional burden? And the commissioner said unfunded mandates don't work, and I'm assuming that he was talking about unfunded mandates to counties. So if you can just kind of answer that, I'm concerned about my counties. I'm concerned about the burden this will put on them, their ability to do all of this, and the cost to the county.
Go ahead. Chair Considine, Representative, I can answer if the commissioner's still here, I believe, yep, and he can weigh in as well. Yeah, I think that's a very legitimate concern. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Community Corrections Act counties, and I can tell you that all of those counties, from our perspective, are concerned about the shift in responsibility without a shift in resource. I don't know that we would volunteer to. The trick here, right, is figuring out how we make sure that both can be true. That the responsibility and the programming can occur in the community setting. At the same time, I think there's an acknowledgement that it just has to be resourced, because the counties are not going to want to bear the burden on that. In fact, many of them have for the past several years, and I think some are getting to the point where they just can't anymore.
Before you go on, Commissioner Snell, we kind of have a hard deadline at 3:55 to adjourn. So if we could keep the questions and the answers as brief as possible, we would appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would just add, we are in full agreement. We believe and know that in order to make this work, and I think as we talk as a system, and I want to just really reiterate that, I think it's important that we understand that we reflect a system, and that system has to be resourced, and that is a shared responsibility between state and county. And so we're here saying that in order to do this, in order to reduce that population and meet these needs, it has to be resourced at the community level.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to say that I very much appreciate the work you do. So I'm a prosecutor when I'm not here, and my fellow committee members are probably tired of me saying that. But I will say that I have read a number of the reports and the investigations that you put together in the course of my duties, and the fact that you can do a PSI in 5 to 6 hours is pretty amazing because of all the information and the research that goes into that. So I appreciate that. One thing I don't know much about, though, are the cognitive behavioral interventions, and I just wondered if you could give us some examples of that.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Chair Constantine and Representative Mueller. I mean, I'll add some. I don't know if Terry wants to chime in as well, but really there's two different ways to look at cognitive skills interventions, I think. One is there are a lot of individual cognitive skills interventions that probation officers do in their office with their client one-on-one. So there are carry guides and there are bits, and I know these are all just like terms, but right, we have these tools that we can use with them one-on-one. And then in addition to that, then we try to offer a lot of cognitive skills programs and groups that we invite 10 clients into or 14 clients into and offer this program to them over a period of 26 to 30 weeks, you know. So it's got to be a good mix. I think that the one thing around that is there are agencies right now piloting programs called Dosage, and really it's about then getting those clients a specific number of those hours, 100, 200, 300 hours of cognitive skills program, because we know those programs work. So it's got to be a combination of both those individual interventions and those group interventions, and then getting our community providers to also buy into that same kind of programming. That sort of mix is what we need, and at a dosage that makes sense for the risk level of the client.
Representative Snell, or sorry, Commissioner Snell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just say, I the other night I attended a graduation, a cognitive skills graduation, and I thought it was a great example that was provided. It was a person who had been in Challenge Incarceration Program, and he talked about the kind of the importance of, you know, he's well into his 30s. He had served several years, a couple of years in prison, and then went to Challenge Incarceration, which is, you know, a pretty intensive program that includes a lot of cognitive skills and treatment. And he comes back into the community after it being in this highly structured program, and now all of the patterns of the previous 30 years that led to him getting into prison become a part of, he's back into that environment. And so the notion of kind of rethinking how he does things, and he provided a really good example where he described this thing of, you know, in the past, what I would do is I knew I had to be and meet my probation agent at on Thursday morning at 9 a.m. And the first time I would think about how I was going to get there was at 8:55 at Thursday morning. And I would come to the realization I simply can't get there. And this is just patterns and trends that people develop that ultimately result in their thinking changes to the point where he knows he's now in trouble. Forget it. It doesn't matter. I'm going back. And that and the thinking just kind of takes him down into this hole. And you can begin to see how important the work that the agents do with these folks of really kind of retraining that thinking to avoid the traps that gets them stuck in this trap of going back and going back. And I think that's one of the most exciting things to see and hear from people. And as somebody who, you know, who has really been more of an observer than a practitioner at that level, I've been amazed at the work and the outcomes that can be achieved when there is strong fidelity to the practice.
We got three more people that are on the list, not taking any more after that. Please keep it brief.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So just one quick follow-up then. So mental health services for either inmates or your clients, I mean, having read a lot of these PSIs, I see the trauma that a lot of the clients have faced in their lives, and we know a lot now about brain impact and all of that. And so I'm just wondering, we also know there's a shortage of providers too. If you could just briefly address that, it would be helpful.
Mr. Chair.
Representative, I think just from a, I'll talk from a facility standpoint and some of that transition. As we think about the need, the demand for mental health services, and it's troubling to look at some of the complexity of the needs of the people that are coming into the system. And really our, in some cases, our lack of ability to provide meaningful intervention in the period of time that they're gonna be with us. One is we're thinking about the ways in which we bring people in and are, should we be providing these intensive services early on and then keeping a dose throughout the remainder of their time inside so when they get out they can better be supported by supervising agents is one option. And then the other option is we look at the needs of people that are oftentimes coming back on violations because of mental health issues. As opposed to having these people sit in prison and waiting for available treatment bed, where we're beginning to explore is looking at the ability to procure and obtain those services in the community in concert with supervision. Because we think, again, it goes back to this thing of meeting their needs in the community does seem to make the most sense.
If I could add just briefly. From a community supervision perspective, I mean, when we talked about responsivity, right, I know I blew through kind of the risk needs and responsivity pieces. One of our jobs then is to assess if mental health is a driver of their criminal behavior, then we need to do something with that. So it is trying to get the provision of service for that client based on their risk to make sure that gets addressed. But as we'll see in some of the more rural counties, access to mental health services is a challenge. But it's certainly a responsivity factor that I think all of us try to address. Yeah.
Thank you so much. Brevity is a lost art, especially in complicated things. Representative Dean, please.
Thank you, Chair Considine. And first off, to the folks associated with probation, you guys do amazing work. And if it's done right, you have amazing products, which I don't really like to think, but it's people leading their best lives. As I'm hearing all this talk, I hope that in the future, every presentation by either folks from Corrections Association, from MACAC, from the DOC, like, goes jointly. Because all of this stuff is interconnected. And as I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about your earlier presentation, Commissioner Schnell, about actually reducing the needs for beds, we know that as you continue to reduce the need for beds, that changes sort of the financial needs of DOC. And at some point, we reach a tipping point that we actually begin to see significant savings. And then how those savings might actually meet the obligation that you all are trying to do, and if there's more people on probation, and if there's not more funding, that'll never happen. So, Commissioner Stell, if you could just, if you think about, you know, the mission, what you're trying to do, what we might see here in the near future, whether it's, just reduction of beds or possibly closing of a particular facility, what that might then do to support probation and community supervision. If you could speak to that, that would be great.
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative, I think that is absolutely the question. And I think as we recognize that, and I think this has been the case across the country, we cannot continue to ask for a bigger pie. We have to begin to think about the ways in which we cut this pie that makes the most sense and is sustainable. And as we look at population reduction and meeting people's needs in the community, there is the potential that we could shift our investments into bricks and mortar, and bricks and mortar, I would add, that has a lot of needs, capital needs, that ultimately we might see a time when closures of a facility could actually be reinvested back into the supervision side, but not just supervision, but actually build up and lift up the ability of a community to meet its broader needs, not just the correctional population, but its broader needs. And I think that this has been a discussion that has been happening, is justice reinvestment. And we have been having conversations along with our partners here of bringing in and engaging some folks from outside to actually explore this along with all of you and our members of the judiciary. And what could this look like in Minnesota in a way that we could actually try to create a sustainable system that meets the public safety demands that this state has?
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. Representative O'Neill, really quickly. Representative Johnson, I'm sorry. I don't think you're going to get in. I had some questions also that I'm not going to get in. If you submit them, we will make sure you get in.
Not questions or statements.
So I'm sorry.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really quickly, Pine County budget for probations. Can you just let us know how big that is or how small that is? I know Pine County is not a big county. And then I have a question for Commissioner Schnell, which is back to statute, the 244.19, when it, if I'm reading the words, my colleagues know I love words. It says the Commission of Corrections shall annually from funds appropriated for that purpose pay 50% of your cost for probation's officers. And I'm just wondering the why is that? Is the legislature appropriating that and it's just passed through the DOC, or does the DOC have some control over that funds? Just trying to get to the bottom of the funds. Thank you.
Please, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. Pine County's budget, it just went up a little bit because now we went to the county scale, so we're right about $1 million. Still pretty small, and you consider that's 10 staff, including myself. I'll let the commissioner, I think, respond to the CPO reimbursement. Okay. Well, right, this last year, I think reimbursement was at 29%. The last several years have been about 29-30%. That doesn't include support staff. That only includes agents, minus one agent that's paid for under a grant, under a caseload workload grant. So that's seven people now that are under CPO reimbursement. And this last year, I believe our reimbursement dollars were $350,000, if I'm thinking. Like I said earlier, the county picks up quite a bit of that. If Commissioner Helen was here, he would say that it's hard to talk about surplus when you're not getting 50% reimbursement. Thank you.
Go ahead, Commissioner Snell.
All right, Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill. This is a question that I'm going to go back and get some additional information on for one, but I do know that this has been an area of concern for a long time, the levels of reimbursement at both at the community corrections as well as the CPO, and yet the statute is very clear. I think along the way what's happened is that appropriation was not increased on that front. We have not always been asking for that as well. I know in the one time I was made an ask, we did not, that was not necessarily reflected there. And I think one of the things that has been challenging and an issue is as we look at how we fund in many of these areas, we're funding at the CPO level and then at the Department of Corrections level. And this becomes one of the issues that I think as we talk about how we do this, what creates this seamless system, one of our challenges. And so I will definitely get an answer to that, how and what the history is around those requests, because I simply don't know all of that.
Thank you, members. We are at past our hard stop, as Representative Considine characterized it. Thank you, Chair Considine, for this joint hearing. Thank you, Representative Leo, for that last question. That was a really good question. Members, we do have another hearing at 5 o'clock of the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Committee along with the House members, along with the House Judiciary Committee at 5 p.m. at the auditorium of the Mitchell Hamlin Law School. And after that hearing, and that hearing is on broad issues of race and the law. After that hearing, we will host a reception with some good refreshments provided, so hopefully everyone can come and participate and continue that conversation into the early evening. I want to thank MACPRO and MACAC for and DLC for coming here in the spirit in which we invited you, which is quite frankly not for a conversation about partisan issues, but for a conversation focused on problem solving. And I hope that we can keep that spirit going into the legislative session, members, where we do indeed start getting into some pretty deep partisan issues, but we should never forget that we're here to serve the people and to solve problems. We are at a critical juncture, as was shared earlier, and I hope that we can seize that moment in the coming months. So with that, members, and with your permission, Chair Considine, this committee hearing stands adjourned.